Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. This week, I won't have a guest. It's just you and me. And I'm going to give you my take on a few things. First of all, let me take on a big question. I have been saying for almost the entire time I've been on the air that this is about a world that just might work. And so what do I mean by that? What do I think are the biggest issues and problems we face? And what's our challenge? What's the work that we must be about? And here's what I think it is. We need to accelerate the transformation of human activity, particularly as practiced and promoted by the multinational corporations in the U.S. and abroad, from the current emphasis on short-term material production and consumption to an emphasis on long-term learning, meaning, satisfaction, from a culture of greed and competition to one of respect, connection, and cooperation. Now, that is a major, major task. Also, from a worldview that sees reality as a dead machine to one that realizes that reality is alive, it's a living system. From separate, isolated, and alienated individuals looking out only for themselves and some particular small circle of concern, perhaps their family, their religion, their company, their industry, their neighborhood, to seeing themselves as members of a larger community whose actions are linked to the consequences beyond the usual geographical, political, or generational boundaries. See, as life speeds up, those who hold the long-term, big-picture approach, it's really incumbent on us to generate a vision and offer some guidance to deal with the short-term self-interests of individuals and communities. We've got to envision long-term, big-picture community and global self-interest and communicate it well enough that folks can see it as their own self-interest, that their self-interest is our, and I don't mean our, the folks on my side or the folks who think like I do. I mean our, all of us. We've got to see that our self-interest is basically our species self-interest, our planet self-interest, you know, at every level, a little bigger than how you look at it now. And one really key obstacle I see is that current U.S. culture distrusts any elite, in quotes, that would take the role of saying, here's a vision, here's another way to look at things, here's what we've got to be doing. And so our challenge is to overcome that obstacle, is to accept the reality that that's there, that's inbred in our culture, and anything we're going to do has to accept that as a given. How do we deal with that reality? How do we convert and transform that stalemate into movement in the direction of long-term, big-picture survival and success? I don't think we can wait for biological evolution. It's too slow for us as people. It's very fast for microbes who are challenging our antibiotics, but very slow for us. So we need conscious evolution, social evolution, cultural evolution, political evolution. And our job is to expand our own circles of concern and our own time horizons and then work nonstop together in a very creative way to actually make that sort of vision, that sort of way of looking at things spread and spread and spread because our survival depends on it. Now, as much as what I'm describing may sound spiritual or philosophical, politics plays a role in all of this. Politics has tangible effects. 50% or so don't vote, and many who do vote against their own self-interests, and there are, you know, enormous obstacles to politics that actually serves the people, money, ruthlessness, weak, bought-off media, and so on. We know that. We've talked about it many, many times on the show. But that doesn't mean we can step away from it and put our heads in the clouds or the sand, because when you sit on the sidelines, this juggernaut of self-interested, bought-off politicians, industries, finance, all of that is never sleeps, always working to get things their way. And so it's our job to have the same commitment, the same patience, and so on. So human beings doing their best, rising to their highest calling, their highest selves and values, as well as performing to the best of their abilities, that's what excites me. And it seems obvious if you look around in terms of healthcare, education, our relationship to nature. We are not doing our best. Now, is it because we choose money over pursuing our best as a culture, as a society, as a species? And if so, if that's really what's at it, are we aware that that's what we're doing? Do we make such choices by some sort of cost-benefit analysis in which we're just wrong about the costs and the benefits? And how does that happen? Why can't we see it? And can we do anything about it? What needs to change in the way that we perceive or even set up the risks and the incentives in our society? And how do we change that? One thing I really believe is that I and any who share this sort of purpose and vision need to get better at communicating. As I said, the old ways and the 1% have basically unlimited funds. And they will use politicians and they will use the media to spread their message. And their message basically is there's no alternative. It's our way or no way. It's our way or you're cut out. But what they ignore is that actually the vision that I'm talking about has human nature ultimately on its side. Science has learned that cooperation is actually innate in us. Evolution is not simply driven by survival of the fittest individuals, but rather by survival of the fittest species or the fittest ecosystem. To those who would say that competition is the law of nature, Edmund O. Wilson of Harvard points out there's cooperation among animals. The first prairie dog who stands up and barks surely dies, but his warning saves the lives of others, and so the trait takes hold. Packs that include the most dogs who get up and bark are the packs who survive. Most of us don't know that, and most of us don't know we don't know that. We just accept this notion of survival of the fittest and competition, and it's us and them, and my win is your loss, and your win is my loss. We need to use creativity, authenticity, and emotional truth to invite and challenge and inspire the action that it's going to take to create truly radical change. And radical, by the way, doesn't mean on the fringe, out of the mainstream. Radical comes from the same root as the word root. Radical means getting to the root of things. And that's what I'm talking about here, is really radical change at the very level of how we see the world and how we experience what it is to be human. Now, how do we get people to aspire to these ways of looking at things and these ways of living? One notion that I suggest could help us get out of some of the blind alleys and the traps of conventional wisdom and opinion about what's possible is to imagine, is to use our imagination. Obviously, imagination is going to be a huge player in freeing us from what we feel trapped in right now. So the imagination, the thought experiment I suggest, is stand in the future. Go to 2035. 2040, 2050, and ask, how did humanity turn things around? And if they did, how did they do it? And as you can imagine, if your answer to that is, no, we didn't, well, that's a pretty dark prospect. But if you are able to imagine that we did, then you can ask how we did it. What made people stop acting out of fear? What made them realize that we are all in this together? Because some big players have failed at this. Christ wasn't able to do it. Communism wasn't able to do it, although both of them actually say it's what they're about, but didn't happen. But rather than focus on the obstacles in front of us right now, as I've been laying them out, we have to imagine a future in which those obstacles have been overcome and then work backwards. with the freedom of, well, how did that happen? How did we do it? And imagine what changes. Some are probably social. Some are probably technological. Some might be political. Some might be terrible crises that finally led us to realize how serious things were. That may be what it takes. Rebecca Solnit, the wonderful essayist who has been on the show a few times, she has a wonderful book called Paradise in a Place Called Hell. And she went down to New Orleans and the area of the Gulf after Katrina. And when the news reports were all emphasizing looting and violence and lawlessness, what she actually found was people who were pulling together, people who were communicating with perhaps people they didn't normally communicate with, collaborating with people perhaps they didn't normally collaborate with, because there was a common plight they found themselves in. And she, you know, realized that, in fact, this is what happens in our lives. When the earthquake happened here in 94, people pulled together. When the snowstorms happen, and obviously we're actually getting to practice this more and more these days because we have more and more of these natural disasters. What she did was she went back and she looked at six different disasters, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, etc. And she found that this was a recurring pattern, that a common danger, a common obstacle brings us together. It makes all the sense in the world. So that's what I suggest, is that we begin to imagine we have pulled ourselves out of this, imagine that we've succeeded, and then imagine how we did it. If we can change the story, we can change the world. And if we can't change the story, then we probably can't change anything. And so that's kind of where the next hour shakes out. This takes me to much of what I do when I'm not working on this radio show. I teach individuals and organizations to tap the unique power of story and narrative. And if communication is part of your work, or your organizing, or your community efforts, I recommend that you learn to tap this power. Ask yourself, have you ever told a story that made something, your job, your product, your campaign, your cause come to life? Really made it come to life for someone, and then what happened? At its best, story's not simply a technique. It's not just the current fad, although it certainly is that right now. But it's not just the current fad that you add to what you were doing yesterday to make it shiny. I really can't emphasize enough that it has to do a great deal with the quality of your listening to others and to yourselves. Remember this. Stories emerged under the sky, around campfires, or when two people shared what they saw and what they knew and who they were. A story is not a dead, static, solitary thing. There's something in the essential nature of a narrative that has to do with its being shared. I visited the rainforest of Ecuador in the late 90s, and I was with the nonprofit Pachamama, and they have an alliance with a tribe down near the Ashuar. The Ashuar did not have contact with the modern world until the 1970s, okay? And the leader of the Ashuar at the time was a 29-year-old, so he's someone that had been born in a sense for them was prehistory. And he was with us as we took a trip by boat deep into the rainforest. And we visited a very small village where a former warrior, now sort of tamed by the contact with the West, as ironic as that may seem. And the two of them met for the first time. So here's a warrior probably in his 50s and this young 29-year-old leader. And they spent about 10 minutes talking with each other in what almost seemed like song as they went in the Ashuar language, back and forth and back and forth before the rest of us just standing around and watching. And what it was, I asked him afterwards, what they were doing was they were telling the story of their families. If you remember in the Bible, so-and-so begat, and so-and-so begat, and he begat, and she begat, that's basically what they were doing, their entire history of their family, and that was the what you did when you first met someone, you told the story. If you go to Hawaii, there's a great deal of attention paid to talking story. Most indigenous people realize that sharing stories is an essential part of life. For years, I've been saying that stories, in the workshops that I do and the speeches and the consulting and so on, that stories are a unique resource you can use to build credibility with new audiences, to deepen the engagement and trust with those that are already on board with you. And I still believe stories have unique power, but I've come to think that good stories are not enough. What's become clear and clearer to me over the years is that the strongest communication is often the combination of data and story. Because data does such a great job of presenting challenges and tracking accomplishments and demonstrating value. And it speaks to, of course, we know, we can imagine, to a different part of us. We want to reach people through their hearts and their minds. The story reaches their hearts, and the data often reaches their minds. So think of it this way. If you're buying into what I'm saying and you're thinking of using story to build your cause or improve your work, etc. Whenever you come up with a great piece of data, find a compelling human story that illustrates it. And if you learn about a great story in your company or in your organization, then see if you can link it to a piece of data. This way, you get to both hearts and minds, and you demonstrate if you add a piece of data to a story, you help people get over that feeling that it's just that's just an anecdote, that's just one little feel good anecdote. And since you're communicating in order to make things happen, whenever possible, add the third element. Don't be afraid to do this. In fact, be hard on yourself. Make sure that you do this. Link the story and the piece of data to the call to action that's up for you right then. When your purpose is advocacy, link a powerful story, a memorable piece of data, to your funding request, your policy recommendation, whatever it is you're doing. Story, data, call to action. And if you can get you and your team to be thinking this way and expressing yourselves this way, I tell you, you're going to have more success. Now, one thing about data is that I recommend one piece of data. Too much data and people get overwhelmed. We know this. So find that one number that's memorable, surprising, easy to understand, maybe even able to generate a picture in the mind's eye. And so what I'm saying is I believe you need to get better and better at delivering these story packages. Powerful story, great piece of data, clear call to action, and that this is something which can move people and get through to them in a way that other things can't. I work mostly with nonprofits, foundations, and public agencies, and they have great stories about people, about courage, about change, overcoming obstacles, achieving goals. And so what my job when I'm working with them is to say, you have this enormous asset, this very valuable asset, and you have to use it. Now, one question that I think is essential to understand is, why is story and narrative so powerful? What is it that makes it powerful? What do you think? This is Free Forum, by the way. I'm Terrence McNally, and it's a little different this week. Instead of doing an interview, I decided I would share with you some of what I found valuable. I'm not interviewing anyone. I'm just talking with you. And if you want to learn more about my work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldatjustmightwork.com to the same website. And as I said, we'll take some calls towards the latter part of the hour at 818-985-5735. So, Salman Rushdie says about story, we are storytelling animals. We are the only creature on earth that tells itself stories in order to understand what its life means. Therefore, the story is of unusual importance to us. Whether we're writers or not, it is something unusually important to human nature. Why? Well, it has to do with culture, A culture is basically the set of stories that a group agrees on. Jerome Bruner says to be in a viable culture is to be bound in a set of connecting stories. That's one way to think of what is a culture. It's the stories they agree on. This has been true since tribes and since time immemorial. It also has to do with identity. We are the stories we tell others and the stories we tell ourselves. If you meet someone for the first time, or you go for a long drive together, you strike up a conversation with someone on a plane, or you go on a first date, there's probably a set of stories that you tell. And to some extent, those stories are who you are. Roger Schenck in Tell Me a Story, Narrative and Intelligence, says, we tell stories to describe ourselves, not only so others can understand who we are, but also so we can understand ourselves. And telling our stories allows us to compile a personal mythology. And the collection of stories we have compiled is to some extent who we are. Then it has to do with memory. And this makes great sense in terms of our history and our evolution. Until the invention of writing, stories how we remembered enough to survive. Stories are basic to the human memory process. The mind establishes a storyline, and the memory of one event triggers the memory of the next. So if you have important facts that you want to deliver, put them in a story. Think of it like a necklace of pearls. Your facts are the pearls, and the story is the necklace. It has to do with framing. Here's a very important thing, which if you watch politics in America, is clear as a bell. Facts do not have the power to change someone's story. Your goal is to introduce a new story that lets your facts in. Okay? And we see this over and over and over again. You hit yourself and you say, how can they? That's just wrong. Whether it has to do with climate change or the war on drugs or health care. I mean, any issue you look at, there are beliefs that are put out there that just the facts don't back them up, and yet they have power. And then you'll see people, and obviously I think President Obama has been guilty of this on a number of occasions, thinking, and we all have. I mean, we'll confront somebody and we'll come up with, but didn't you know, and we'll tell them some fact. Doesn't make any difference. In fact, I had Chris Mooney on the show talking about the Republican brain and why America is so, why Americans don't believe science. And it turns out that actually sometimes you tell them facts, people hear facts that contradict their story, it makes them more insistent than ever that their story is true. It doesn't make sense, but it's the way our minds work. I think the Republicans over the years have been much better at this framing. Just whether it's Frank Luntz or Karl Rove, and they've had their losses lately. But I mean, think about it: the death tax that frames the conversation about inheritance tax, big government, and the naming of policies like calling something the direct opposite of what it is just gets in the way and fogs up the brain so that facts don't even have a chance to get in. I thought the 2004 election was just the greatest example of this ever. They framed John Kerry so well that they didn't need to even remind you of the frame. Words and ideas and even images stuck to it like Velcro. And I believe the frame was, he's not like you. He's not a regular American. He's somehow foreign. And then all you had to do was hear the word Massachusetts or his wife's name pronounced with an accent, Teresa, or see a picture of him windsurfing. And they all just reinforce this notion. Now, what's interesting is I've been citing that example for years, but the Obama administration copied it skillfully in 2012. In an interview in Rolling Stone, former Clinton consultant James Carville said exactly that. As soon as Romney was nominated, and while he was making the transition to the general election, they spent a lot of ad money defining him as one of the 1%, a private equity guy from Bain Capital who cut jobs and outsourced jobs. And Carville says that the reason that the video of his statement about the 47% who pay no taxes had such an impact is because it confirmed the image that the campaign had already been putting out. Okay? So stories, if you want to change someone's story, you can't do it with facts. You've got to tell a better story. At a very young age, children start telling stories to their stuffed animals, to their pets, to each other. They tell us back the stories that we tell or read to them. They don't start talking in abstract notions until 6, 7, or 8. Story is our native language. And if you were told or read stories as a child, most of them probably stuck to a classic structure. Beginning, middle, and end. Heroes and villains. Goals and obstacles. And finally, morals or messages. It works in fairy tales. It works in folklore. It works with children. It works with us throughout our lives. So, what makes a good story? Okay, if we agree that story is powerful and has sort of unique powers that we're not going to get with facts or graphs or PowerPoints or any of that, what are the elements of a good story? It turns out there is a classic structure that's been with us from Aristotle to contemporary Hollywood. And there are a few qualities that many of them share as well. So the structure is this. Who's the protagonist? The lead character, the hero. Stories need someone to drive the action, someone for the audience to follow and identify with and root for. So you establish a protagonist. Then when your story begins, you want to set up that life is normal. This is a day in the life. This is a moment. I'll tell you a quick story, and you'll see the examples in it. This is a story. I heard it from Andy Goodman, who also does a great deal of work with story and narrative. But it originates with Richard Eyer and his wife, Linda. They teach parenting skills, so they're always on the lookout for examples of good parenting. Their website is valuesparenting.com. So Richard's in the supermarket. He's at the fish counter. His number's been called, and he's just about to place his order when he hears a woman nearby with a screaming 2-year-old in the shopping cart. And the kid is, you know, just letting loose. And he overhears the mother say, "It's going to be okay, Jennifer. We've just got to get cereal and milk and bread, and we're going home." And he's so impressed with how calm she is. But before he can talk to her, he's got to order his fish. It's got to be cut and wrapped and so on. So he's stuck there at the fish counter. She goes off. Once he's got his stuff and he goes to follow her, she's down at the end of an aisle. There's 3 or 4 shopping carts between them. The kid is still screaming, and he hears her again. "We've got the bread, Jennifer. We're just going to get the cereal and the milk, and we're going home." And he wants to get to her, but he can't get past all those carts, so he figures it out. "Well, wait a minute. I know she's only got 2 more items. I'll go wait for her at the checkout counter." So he goes. Sure enough, in about a minute, here she comes. The kid is still screaming. And he hears the mother say, "It's okay, Jennifer. We've got everything we need. We've just got to pay for it, and we're going home." And he goes over to her and he introduces himself. "I'm Richard Eyer. I am always looking for examples of good parenting for my website, my work. And I got to tell you, I'm so impressed with your calm, the way you're talking with your children. How old is little Jennifer?" To which the woman says, "I'm Jennifer." Now, when I tell that story in workshops, it not only always gets a laugh, but that little simple story demonstrates all the stuff I'm going to tell you about the structure of a story. As I said, you need a protagonist. Well, that's Richard. His life is normal. He's buying fish. Something happens. And this is the key thing in a story. Something happens that interrupts the status quo, that interrupts normalcy. And that inciting incident sends your hero off in pursuit of a goal. In this case, it's he overhears the mother and child, and he wants to go find them. In movies, basically, most movies are set up in a 3-act structure, and in that first act, we get to meet our hero, we watch them, we get a setup of what their life is like normally, and then something happens, and that something sets them off in pursuit of, you know, the pot of gold, the love interest, the career, whatever it is. And now, here's the thing. If you have a story for your organization or your company or your cause in which you set out to accomplish something and everything went perfectly, A, B, C, D, accomplished, it's a wonderful accomplishment, congratulations, but it's not a great story, because what we like in our stories is obstacles and barriers. It's the how our hero overcomes the obstacles to achieve their goal. That's what makes it matter. That's what makes our empathy, our caring, our emotional involvement. And if you think of it this way, Shakespeare tells you that the Montagues and the Capulets are involved in a blood feud before you even meet Romeo and Juliet. Or to put it another way, Superman without kryptonite is boring. Okay? You need obstacles, and that's what it's in the overcoming, as I say, the overcoming of the obstacles and the barriers that you learn what resources your hero has. Is it charm? Is it strength? Is it stamina? Is it courage? What is it that helps them get over these barriers to achieve their goal? Now, let me say that when someone in a workshop or a client asks me, gives me something and says, is this a good story? I've tried to boil it down for myself and see what I'm looking for in sort of shorthand. And here's what I look for. Three things. First, is there at least one flesh and blood character? Okay? One flesh and blood character. To write about organizations, to write about ideas, to write about movements, there's Powell, or to tell stories about them. It's better than a graph. It's better than a dry academic case study. But if you can give them a human being, then you've got something. You've got something to work with. You've got something to identify with. Second, so the first thing is one flesh and blood character. And what do I mean by flesh and blood? You've told us enough that we can actually get a feel for them. We can see them in our mind's eye. We care about them. Doesn't take a lot, but just enough that we can do that. Then, second, does something change or does a question get answered? This is important because it's what gives the story momentum. You set something up. This is that goal that's set up in the first act. This is something you set up when you're telling a quick story. You set up either a question at the top or something that is going to be that the story is all about the change from being alone to being in love, from being broke to being slumdog millionaire. Right? It's that the change that you tell them about that we're looking for in the first act, and then we follow that. And so it's in, as I said, that gives you the dynamics, the momentum that keeps you going. And third, do you give us some scenes in your story? Whether it's a brief 1-minute story or you've written a 3-page story or it's a 10-minute story, whatever it is, do you give us some scenes between a couple of people or more where there's actual dialogue? When you give us a scene and have two people talk to each other, we listen differently. We know we're not just listening to facts. We know we're not just listening to description or ideas. We're listening to people. When you put words in the mouths of your characters and have them talk to each other. So what you do is you're telling a story. It's about a 2-minute story. 2 or 3 times, you just go, as I did with Richard in that story about Richard and Jennifer and Jennifer's daughter. It's the dialogue that lets us know we're actually in something that's happening and not just something we're talking about. Okay? At least one flesh and blood character, something changes or a question gets answered, and scenes with dialogue. What are some of the other qualities of good stories? Concise but colorful. You've got to be concise enough that people can follow your story. You know, you don't want to drag on forever. There are some great storytellers who can do that, who can tell the Shaggy Dog story that goes on forever, but not many of us can. People like their stuff, you know, come at me fast. What's the point? Cut to the chase. So you want to be concise, but you also want to be colorful so that people get involved. And one way you do that is with very specific details. It's interesting. There's a paradox, and I've watched it for years in the realm of story. The more specific the detail, the more universal the connection. I think it's because general and vague descriptions don't even make an impression, but the very specific one does. I'm just throwing a phrase out. An angular 8th grader in a suit he's about to outgrow sitting in a living room with a few too many knickknacks on the shelves. Okay? Takes a few seconds, nothing complicated, nothing literary about it. But I will wager that you can see that. You can relate to that more. And even if that wasn't exactly you or you haven't exactly been there, the fact that it's specific makes it more real. Okay? Couple more things about stories. Readers experience action as if in real time. Okay? In movies and television, scenes happen in real time. That's how long it takes. You can't, then you'll have a break between scenes maybe where, you know, a month goes by. But in that scene, it's happening right then. That's the way stories have to feel. It's happening right now. It's happening in the present. We're inside of it. We're not outside looking in. We're not looking back. It's happening now. It's right there. We use the present tense a lot when we're talking about it. In other words, right? Richard sees the woman. He hears the child. It's present tense, and so it feels that way. And then that key thing is we got to stay till the end to learn what happens. Stories of this kind, these narrative stories, are the opposite of classic journalism. Classic journalism, in the first paragraph, who, what, when, where, and how, right? Because the way journalism works is you want to give people what happened. And in as quickly as you can, and then if they want to learn more, if this is a story that interests them, then they read and they find out the details and the history and everything. In a story, it's the opposite. It's through the scenes and the details that we build up, and we do not find out what happens until they all come together. Okay? So you want to show us how a character changes or a question gets answered in that story. So you want to set things off up at the top and pay them off at the end. Challenges, and then they overcome. That sort of thing. So you're setting things up and then paying them off, and that keeps people involved in your story. Language. You want characters to speak to each other, which I said, that's important if you can have real dialogue. But also remember that you're going to tell your stories to different audiences and gear your language to the audience you're speaking to, okay? Same story can be told lots of different ways, and your goal is to tell it in a way that makes people excited. And finally, emotion. Well, not finally, I have two other things. Emotion. Good stories engage our emotions. That's why we tell them. Narrative carries emotion as well as information. And in fact, that's sort of the deal that you make with your audience. I'm going to slow down a bit here. I'm going to take a little more time here. I'm going to tell you a story, but it'll be worth it because it's going to engage your emotions. Okay? Finally, show, don't tell. Important scenes can't take place off screen. If there's an important change in character, don't go, and then he was completely changed. No, show us the scenes where the changes happen. Show us the scenes where challenges are overcome. Tell us that. Imagine you've been to movies where an important scene happens off screen and you go, wait a minute, what a ripoff that is. No, give people the crucial scenes. And I'll tell you, in my workshops, this is something that is hard to come by. People don't realize that they've done it. You know, so-and-so was having a very tough time and they came to our agency. Now they're doing great. No. What happened? Okay. And the last thing is meaning. You want to have a clear meaning, lesson, or moral. That's why we tell stories. Ira Glass of This American Life, there's a rule in a This American Life story that you have to tell the audience the lesson every few minutes. The basic format of every This American Life story is then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. This is what it means. Then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. This is what we learned. And so you've got to learn to do that. And if you think about just that, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, this is what we learned, that'll be a very simple way to outline almost any story. One other person you might look up if you're interested in story is Marshall Ganz, G-A-N-Z. He worked with the United Farm Workers. He did the storytelling for Obama in 08. He now is teaching and using story at Harvard. Harvard has revamped their whole fundraising, the way they fundraise to emphasize stories. And Marshall Ganz says, there's a story of me, the story of we, and the story of now when you're doing organizing. As you can tell, that's his way is as an organizer, whether with the UFO or, the UFW or Obama or Harvard. The story of me, how does this connect to me personally? What shows I have some skin in the game? Why does this touch me? The story of we, how are we in this together? Why does this matter to you? And the story of now, why is it urgent? Why is it the need to pay attention and do something right now? And Marshall Ganz has done all of his organizing around that use of storytelling. So finally, remember, beyond all those hard criteria I talked about, structure, protagonists, details, obstacles, the bottom line as to whether or not you've got a good story, a compelling story, is does it connect? Does it invite us in? Does it express and evoke emotion in both the listener and the teller? Does it touch us? Does it remind us of our own stories? You know that happens when you hear a story. You remember, oh, I remember my first grade. I remember my first plane trip. I remember, right? And that's a kind of involvement that you don't get without it. And finally, stories build relationships and trust. And that's what so many of us need and want, especially if we're trying to change the world. Okay, someone asked, what do I mean by call to action? So thank you for asking that. What that means is, in my case, maybe I'm saying, here's all this stuff, and my call to action is get involved, get active. That's a pretty general one. But when you tell stories, very often the call to action is, and if you agree with this story, if this story has moved you, then you want to join our movement. That's the call to action is, will you join our movement? Will you buy our product? Right? If you're fundraising for something, it's, will you donate? And what you do is the story gets people involved. The call to action is what you are asking them to do. I'm going to answer Dan. What are the biggest challenges in the global transformation? I think that's much of what I talked about at the start. It's that the overwhelming, nonstop, 24/7 juggernaut of multinationals and their servants who they have bought, whether it's governments or media, they have set up a certain reality. And that reality serves them, and the people change and the names change, but the basic system goes on. And what we have to do is find powerful stories, meaningful stories that will move people to question the given narrative, question the given way of life, and see their own power. I think a great deal of it is that we are told we are not powerful. We are told we are weak. We are told don't bother. We are told there is no alternative. And so I think that's the biggest challenge. I can remember I gave a speech at my 20th college reunion, and I said, it may sound like I'm talking like I'm an environmentalist and I'm talking about the environment, but the piece of the environment that I think most needs change and where the change has to happen is in our consciousness. We have to inspire people and challenge people to think that we actually can do better, that we actually can do differently. I think that's the biggest challenge in global transformation. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, and Mark Maxwell in production. And to you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week.